All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to move briskly to our first panel discussion. Again, as a moderator, I'm going to quickly introduce three distinguished gentlemen, again, many who need no introduction to this room, and then I'm going to get out of the way very quickly so they can share their thoughts. And this session is entitled Serbia and Kosovo, Peace or Partition. I'm going to be very provocative this morning to make sure everybody's awake. But we are absolutely delighted to welcome Professor David L. Phillips, currently the director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. Professor Phillips, his resume is so long, I'm going to go very, very quickly. Just let it be known that he has been a senior advisor and expert to not only the United Nations Secretariat, the State Department, but is a proud think tanker, and we are very glad that Dave was a senior fellow at CSIS, as well as a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and the Atlantic Council, so extremely well known to many, both in the think tank and the academic circle. If I'm not mistaken, you have a book coming out fairly soon. You can tell us all about that. Nice preview of that book. But we're delighted. You made a special trip to be with us amidst a very hectic schedule, so we're going to be extremely prompt in getting David finished with this panel. But thank you for joining us. And then moving down the panel, Ambassador Kurt Volker, Managing Director International at the BGR Group, as well as Senior Fellow and Managing Director of the Center on Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. You have to take a breath after that. We are so delighted that Ambassador Volker could be with us. Again, known to so many in this room, former U.S. Ambassador to NATO, former Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, former Acting Senior Director of the National Security Council, former Deputy to the Private Office of Lord Robertson, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Has been. No. But thank you. Ambassador Volker, and very timely last week, there were hearings on the House side, I believe, on the Balkans. Assistant Secretary Phil Gordon gave some important testimony. I commend it to you, as well as did Kurt. We have copies of his testimony, I think, very much in the theme of our conference today, so we're delighted that you could join us. And then the man of whom I am particularly grateful for, who has been such a stalwart for this project and for me, Haki Abkhazi, who is the program director for the Western Balkans Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. Haki has been certainly our inspiration in thinking through some innovation. His experience in the region has been absolutely extensive and extraordinary. Prior to joining the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Haki served as director of the Kosovo Office for East-West Management Institute, and he's had extraordinary experience in developing management programs in the Western Balkans, as well as Afghanistan and Indonesia. His knowledge of Balkan civil society, I think, is fairly exceptional, and we really welcome your thoughts and insights, and as well your the fund's generosity in helping us with this program. So with no further ado, Mr. Phillips, over to you. Thank you.
Heather, thank you for having me today. I also appreciate you reconfiguring the schedule a little bit. I'm due at Harvard to leave a seminar today at 3, so I'm going to make a little bit of a fast exit. I'm not sure I'll be there.
Let's hope the weather and the shuttle gods are with us.
Indeed. Inshallah. I also just want to pay special tribute to Janusz Bogajski. Over the past 20 years in this room, you've really kept Balkan issues front and center for the Washington community, and the contribution that you've made and continue to make should be fully acknowledged. I also want to just say a word about my very old and dear friend Sven Alkali. You know, both personally and professionally, Sven, we've been through a lot over many, many years, and I'm just so delighted that we're here together this morning. It's great to see you. It's great to see so many old friends as well. This topic is intentionally provocative, and I'm going to try to meet the challenge.
Thank you.
The 1974 Constitution of the Federal People's Republic of Yugoslavia was a system of conflict management through decentralization of power arrangements and power sharing between different ethnic groups. Tito's doctrine of brotherhood and unity kept Serbs in check and suppressed social tensions, but it certainly didn't eliminate them. With his death in 1980, he was succeeded by a dysfunctional eight-man presidency consisting of the presidents of the six republics and the heads of Kosovo and Vojvodina. Tito's death gave rise to a virulent combination of ethno-nationalism and the centralization of power by the Belgrade regime. What happened in Belgrade spurred other nationalisms, ultimately resulting in conflict and collapse. Given this experience, it's ironic to me that international mediators chose to replicate the same kinds of approaches in the 74 Constitution to their peace efforts in Bosnia, Kosovo, and in Macedonia. It used diplomacy backed by force in those three countries, and then its mediation was based on a set of guiding principles that elaborated on the core principles of the 74 Constitution. They reject the use of violence in pursuit of political aims, declare there are no territorial solutions to ethnic issues, reassure the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and the unitary character of the state, affirm the multi-ethnic character of society and public life, enshrine the Constitution and the rule of law in order to advance the aspirations of all citizens, and they herald self-government to encourage civic participation and respect for the identity of different communities. These principles were translated into three pillars of post-conflict stability arrangements: power sharing through decentralization and the strengthening of local governance, individual freedoms enshrined in the constitutions, and on top of that, special measures to protect and promote minority and group rights, and a spirit of regional cooperation that we see exemplified in the Stability Pact and the goal of Euro-Atlantic integration to NATO and the European Union. These arrangements really mirrored the Yugoslav constitutional arrangements. They were flawed at the time in Yugoslavia, and these arrangements are flawed when they were promulgated and today. They ultimately failed to keep the peace at the time, and they are failing to create viable nation states as we meet here this morning. Let me see if I can briefly summarize. In Bosnia, we heard already from Minister Alkali that the Dayton Constitution did succeed in ending a terrible war. However, it allocated too much power to the entities, namely the Republika Srpska. The central government included a dysfunctional rotating presidency, a central bank, and a constitutional court, but the entities were given too much authority over policing and fiscal matters. The fact that people in the RS are celebrating their autonomous state is no clearer indication of the flaws to the implementation of the Dayton Peace Agreement. Marty Ahtisaari boasts to me that the Ahtisaari plan represents the best package of minority rights ever put forward. I think, in fact, he's correct about that. It focuses on protecting rights, identity, and the culture of Kosovo's non-Albanian communities, including language, education, healthcare, cultural heritage. It established a framework for the active participation of non-Albanian communities in public life. Wide-ranging local municipal powers provided Kosovo Serb community with a high degree of self-governance. Serb-majority communities were granted extensive financial autonomy, allowed to receive transparent funds from Serbia, and permitted cross-boundary cooperation with Serbian institutions. Maintaining that Belgrade had lost its moral legitimacy to govern, Ahtisaari proposed a period of international supervision, followed by independence with Kosovo, assuming a share of Serbia's international obligations, its debt. The non-performance of the government in Kosovo and its failure to achieve the goal of greater global recognition should by no means be used to question the legitimacy of Kosovo's independence, but they are clearly sources of concern and represent a gap in between the ideals that Mr. Ahtisaari put forward and their practice. Unlike other Balkan countries where ethnic differences escalated into deadly conflict, Macedonians, for the most part, chose dialogue over violence to resolve their differences. The decentralization of power to municipalities is a cornerstone principle of the Oakwood Framework Agreement. I was in Macedonia to convene a conference there by Columbia University and the leading universities in the country on the occasion of the anniversary, and we took note of accomplishments. The provision of amnesty to ex-combatants, the recognition of Albanian as an official language, state funding for Albanian language study in primary, secondary, and university education, affirmative action in the composition of local police, the constitutional court, the ombudsman, the transfer of a wide range of competencies to local government, cultural institutions and activities, as well as the expression of identity through cultural symbols, and the so-called Badinter rule, the double vote allowing legal reforms. While noting the achievements of the Oakwood Agreement, one can't be concerned about Macedonia's ongoing challenges, its inability recently to successfully convene a census is a measure of the difficulties translating principles in documents to practice in governance. These three stability arrangements were based on the promise of Europe's allure. Post-conflict governance in these countries and in Serbia relied on two assumptions. First, that behavior could be modified by the integration into regional and Euro-Atlantic structures. And second, that political leaders prefer enlightened self-interest, choosing a path of cooperation over confrontation. Both of these assumptions have been proven flawed or wrong. Euro-Atlantic integration was seen as an incentive for reform. The rule of law, economic prosperity, EU and NATO membership meant a seat at the table in European decision-making, the free movement of goods and people, and a guarantee of security. The stabilization and association process provided a framework for progress, and assistance was provided through a whole variety of programs, such as cards, focusing on institution building and strengthening civil society. I think that we need to be steely-eyed in recognizing that today the European perspective has proven to be more aspirational than realistic. The Eurozone crisis and the resulting divisions highlights the need for Europe to get its own house in order before pitching a bigger tent. Greece's incompetent tax collection sets the standard for bad governance. Not only is Greece the poster child for fiscal mismanagement, it has shown an infantile pettiness, blocking Macedonia's NATO membership at the 2007 Bucharest summit and obstructing its path to join the EU. Not far behind is Italy, which is guilty of broken promises and failed austerity measures. In response to the current crisis, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has proposed that the EU have special powers, compelling member states to honor commitments and bringing budgets into line, even if that requires diminishing or stripping a country of some of its sovereign rights. Former German Foreign Minister Fischer endorses a breakout. He says, let's just forget about the EU with 27 members. The second assumption upon which these mediation efforts have been based trusts in the better angels of Balkan politicians. They clearly have not been up to the task. Criminality is the best example of regional cooperation. In this instance, Kosovo's government deserves special opprobrium for its rampant corruption, including alleged links to human trafficking at the Medicus Clinic. Let me be clear that I refer to the Medicus instance only. ULEX has been lackadaisical, but is still essential. It should name names and prosecute without reservation or respect for post or privilege. So what's the way forward? With the U.S. prestige waning and Europe in disarray, what's the future for Kosovo and Serbia? The international community will want to avoid instability and the possibility of renewed violence. It will, quite predictably and reflexively, choose to stay the course, even if the promise of a European perspective rings hollow. The ideals, Sven, that you talked about in your remarks are still exemplary and laudatory, ever difficult to realize, perhaps more so today than at any point in the past. The EU can barely manage its own portfolio of members, no less take on burdensome and unpredictable acquisitions. Whether the EU integration is realistic or illusory, the EU should continue to provide assistance and incentives, helping Kosovo and Serbia meet candidacy standards. Regardless of the European perspective, transparent, accountable, and good governance has intrinsic value. Kosovo and Serbia should adopt the Copenhagen criteria as their own. The virus of ethnic nationalism that Haris Salajic spoke about so compellingly over the years is what caused the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. The alternative to Euro-Atlantic integration is the creation of ethnically pure states as an alternative. We've already seen the tragic consequences of action towards this goal. Today, the emergence of a greater Albania or a greater Serbia would cause a new round of human suffering, leading to the dissolution of other former Yugoslav republics. Bosnia and Herzegovina would fragment, Macedonia would break into parts with its Slavic population joining Bulgaria or Serbia. Montenegro might survive as a statelet, with Albanian regions defecting, and the Preševo Valley in Serbia would accede to Kosovo. The deconstruction of these states is clearly an undesirable outcome. Nonetheless, the United States and Europe must continue to work together for democratization based on Western standards and European ideals. At the same time, it's important to recognize the historical, cultural, and commercial affinities of nations in the Balkans. Clustering of interests is an alternative to ethnic partition. In fact, realignment is already underway. It's seen through road, utility, and other kinds of infrastructure that transcend boundaries of the nation state. There are social networks that are in place. We all know that Albanian families have untold dozens of cousins that bind clan and family together. In technology, there's something called the network theory, which starts as science but clearly has social implications. And Megan O'Sullivan, who's now at Harvard and formerly an NSC director, has written about a virtual state. She does that in the context of Iraq with applicability to our discussion here today. Critics will say that realignment is just a pit stop on the path to ethnic partition, that realignment grows black spots on the map, that realignment institutionalizes chauvinism and criminality. As a concept, it is fundamentally heretical to the proponents of stability. It may, however, be a historical inevitability. And given even the possibility of that, great powers need to plan for contingencies. They should be asking themselves, can realignment occur peacefully and through negotiations? Can realignment contribute to stability, not diminish it? And can demilitarization and decriminalization smooth the process of realignment? Euro-Atlanticism is a noble and romantic notion. Proceeding simultaneously, realignment can complement but not replace it. As an alternative to ethnic partition, realignment can help achieve the virtual realization of national goals, reduce extremism that arises from thwarted aspirations, and thereby enhance the viability of state structures. I promise to provide you with some provocative ideas. I welcome your invitation and look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We will have a good discussion about the pros and cons of realignment. Ambassador Volker, over to you.
Thanks very much. I'll try to survey just a little bit. As Heather mentioned, I did testify in the House last week, and so I have a prepared testimony that's rather lengthy. And just as you do in the Congress, I'm not going to read it to you. I'm going to talk, and that's out there in writing if you want to read it. First thing I would say, and this was the heart of the testimony that I gave, is that the premise that we have based our Kosovo and Bosnia, our Balkans policy on for the last 15-plus years has been that the promise of integration into European institutions will be a powerful incentive that will drive the necessary reforms in the regions of the Balkans themselves. And I would agree with Dr. Phillips that that is actually the nicest thing you can say is it's not working right now. And I think that you could go further than that and say the premise has lost credibility. If you take a look at the EU right now, the discussions are whether you can keep everybody in rather than whether you can bring in any more. If you look at NATO, everyone is disinvesting, whether it's in defense expenditure or whether it's in NATO's ongoing operations. How do we end them and get out of them? So the idea that this is going to be a powerful magnet that will incentivize reforms in the Balkans region really doesn't strike me as that credible right now. So that's the first thing. I think that our motor here is not working. We need to rethink some of our approaches. Second, as, again, Dr. Phillips said, the leftovers, after we got through the Dayton process and then left what we left in Bosnia politically, similarly in Kosovo, after the Ahtisaari plan, after independence, what we've got now with Mitrovica and the South, this is now stagnant. It's really not moving anywhere. And, in fact, I think you can argue that because of that, there's then backsliding internally in each of these areas. That is a recipe for future problems if we continue to allow that backsliding to exist. Also, the structures in place reinforce the worst kind of behavior from the leaders of the region. I think you could I would dispute Dr. Phillips' case on one point. I think the people in the Balkans, by and large, especially young people, and especially those who've had a lot of access to Europe, they've seen some return to economic normality in many ways. They have opportunities to travel. There is a desire to get beyond these stagnant structures and backwards politics. However, unfortunately, the political leaderships have not been able to do that. And in fact, as was emphasized, you see resurgent ethnic nationalism being rewarded in political leaderships, and you see the use of the power structures that are there as means of reinforcing economic benefits for the regions and even for the individuals. So I think that we have this disparity between the people and the political leaderships that is part of the problem. So there's an internal dynamic. There is also an external dynamic, and you see radicalization going on of some of the Muslim communities in Bosnia, supported externally by radical Islamist teachers, whether it's in Vienna or whether there's some in Bosnia itself. Fortunately, we don't see as much of that in Kosovo. You also, another external factor I just read about this morning, I don't know if it's true, but I'll mention it, is Russia deciding to allow Serbs in northern Kosovo to obtain Russian citizenship. This is not a helpful thing to do, if that is true. But the bigger point is you have internal problems, external problems, stagnant structures, and what we've been doing until now is not working. Apart from that, everything's fine. What would I therefore suggest? The first thing, let me give you my views on the issue of partition and territorial swaps and things like that. I don't think it actually solves any problems. It is a attractive and convenient and neat solution to say, well, this territory is predominantly Serb and this one's predominantly Albanian. We'll swap them, and that will lead to greater stability. I just don't buy it. There are, first off, even in these areas, there is no such thing as ethnic purity that would justify, okay, this is this and this is that. Moreover, there shouldn't be the goal of creating ethnic purity. That is a large part of what we've been trying to do in the Balkans, is to get beyond that notion and say that all the people of the region need to live together based on principles of governance and economics and integration and cooperation. Going down the road, even in one small step, to reward and accept the idea that things ought to be divided on an ethnic basis would be a huge mistake. When you get outside the specific areas that people talk about with Kosovo, you then open up a much wider can of worms, because it's not only in Kosovo where you have the borders not corresponding neatly to ethnic groups, but throughout the whole region still, whether it's Bosnia or Serbia or Macedonia or Montenegro and so on. So I don't think that idea, as simplistically attractive as it can sound, actually solves any problems. Now, if people agree and they want to do something, I don't know that anyone's going to stand in their way. But that said, I don't think that is something to be encouraged. I think it is something that we should try to get do better then. And how to do better? If the motor of European integration is not powerful enough to force any kind of change these days, I would argue then we should flip it around. I would like to see the EU, the United States, and NATO increase their efforts in the Balkans to push for political resolutions to the lingering problems that are there. I think we have, over the years, taken an increasingly hands-off role. We've seen the powers of the High Representative less and less supported by the European Union, for example, in Bosnia. I think we have been less deeply engaged in pushing specific solutions in Kosovo. I think it's time to up the ante, redouble efforts, so that if we can actually make progress on these, we can then make the prospect of European integration more realistic again. And I want to just point out that I agree, and I've been reminded, and I accept the point that Vice President Biden, Jim Steinberg as Deputy Secretary of State when he was Deputy Secretary, also Phil Gordon with some very good speeches and engagement in the Balkans, have been involved, no doubt about it. But I still feel like there is not sufficient U.S. leadership in the process. I think the U.S. has handed off too much to the EU with the expectation the EU will play the lead. The EU, meanwhile, is having its own internal problems and is disengaging itself from the Balkans as well. So I would like to see a re-energization of U.S. leadership as part of that process. And if we do that, I think we can get back on track. And a final word, and I think it's just important to put it in the broader context, the idea, the romantic, naive, simple notion of a Europe whole, free, and at peace is really the ultimate goal that we have to keep pressing for. And I think we've lost a lot of momentum because of the difficulties. We've lost momentum because of our internal challenges, our finances. We've lost momentum because Russia has become much harder to deal with. But all that said, we will never feel safe, secure, and we will never have a complete Europe until all the citizens of Europe are able to live in free, prosperous, and secure societies. And we have to keep up the efforts to drive that. Difficult as it is now, that still has to be the long-term goal. Thank you.
Kurt, thank you very much. Very thought-provoking. Thank you so much. Haki, put all of this neatly into a package. We have realignment. We have losing the European motor. All right, here you go.
It's very hard to know what is left for me to say, actually, but since I'm here, I'm going to use the opportunity. So thanks for having me here. And I'm going to try to bring it a little bit kind of at the level where I work on a daily basis to reflect on some of the underlining issues that then can kind of get into the politics of the Balkans. But let me bring kind of a comparison of Afghanistan today and the Balkans today. And the reason why I want to do this is to show how actually the approaches of international community forces us to change and make the time to change, not because things have been working, but because it took too long to realize that they're not working. And I don't think simply the blame goes to EU or US not paying enough attention. I think it's too simplistic. I think the approach to the post-conflict situation has been showing all over the world that is not really the right one. Even though we see and might see the political figures and political representation coming fresh after the conflict, I think to a large extent we ignore a very important factors of economic development and the transactions that happen within the state, like privatization, for example, and then getting big corporations into the regions where the conflict has happened. what we see as a kind of a similar, almost the same kind of pattern in Afghanistan and in the Balkans is that we have elections. You remember Loya Jirga when Karzai and the constitution and everything was a cheering moment. And then you also remember some good, great success stories of Serbia having a new leadership, Koštunica, Kosovo, continuing with Rugova, and then Bosnia kind of trying to come to the point of having a good leadership. But what was kind of not ever paid enough attention is what was happening with properties of these countries and where it was ending up. So a lot of people who made their funds and money and wealth during the collapse of the communist socialist system, they were the ones to actually be on the front line of benefiting from the war economy and industry. And then later, almost the same people were the ones to privatize publicly and socially owned enterprises. And on the next phase, they were the same to control the political elites by corrupting deeply the structures in these places. So how could ever one think that we would have a good positive outcome of a process that has had only one coherent, continuous kind of process, and that's corruption, criminality, and every excellent way of avoiding the rule of law. So we had created these two parallel lives, or three actually. One, international community and good faces of politics, people who speak nicely around conferences. The second is the people who live there because they have no choice. They have to live their daily life. Sometimes we blame that they are not participating, they are not enough powerful, they are not loud enough to control their political establishments. And the third is the criminal network, as it was pointed here, that works perfectly because they don't have any difference, ethnic or any other. They speak the same language, and that's money. And that has been working very, very well in the Balkans. It's working very, very well in Afghanistan. That's why we are where we are. Even the money that was pumped into those regions by international community, it ended up empowering exactly those networks that continued to hinder and challenge democratic processes in these countries. So I wanted to make that point because I think today's problem, it's not an ethnic problem at all. If municipalities in south part of Kosovo, Serbs and Albanians, Roma and Bosniaks, can live together, you can go now in 2 months and ski in Brezovica in Kosovo, where 99% of people who manage places are Serbs, and 99% of people who go to ski and use the resources are Albanians. They work perfectly fine. There are no NATO troops. There are no OSCE reconciliation programs. There is nothing that is going on there except a common interest to live together and enjoy life and go back to their families peacefully. So we forget this element of every single individual wanting to go back in a peaceful way and have a peaceful life. Very often, because we tend to close ourselves in the offices and make calculations about who is doing what from a big picture, we tend to forget the fundamental ingredients of the peace that are people down there in their lives. Then we move to this idea of, United Nations has created a new resolution to demand dialogue between Serbia and Kosovo. I mean, just look back, less than 8 months, what that dialogue has done to Kosovo and Serbia. Has destroyed almost every single connection that has been built in last 10 years. By putting, again, the opposite sides in front of the camera in Brussels, with no agenda, absolutely no transparency about what is being talked about, and with the special envoys or EU representatives coming to Serbia and Kosovo and not even bothering to make a public statement of why they are there. So what does that create? An opportunity for very radical movements in the region to say, here is another ambiguous situation where we can take advantage of and we can continue with our agenda, believing that they can get through again. So what that tells us, that the war actually in the Balkans has never ended. We do have two agreements that kind of seize the war, but the war in minds of people has never, in minds of the political leaders, has never ended. If you have a police member of Kosovo being shot, and then the person who killed that official policeman can still freely go around in the Balkans without being threatened by rule of law, without even having fear that EULEX, which is one of the biggest ESDP missions, can get, why do you think that the other people will not think the same, that you can still kill people in the Balkans and still be free? And maybe in 15, 20 years, Hague will try to get you. Or maybe some local court is going to be capable and impartial enough to create those cases. So I think we need to realize that Dayton Agreement and Kumanova Agreement have kept the region in a very fragile and stalemate. We need to move on into a new phase of discussion and debate beyond the idea of a simple dialogue that has no agenda and is done there because there are political check marks that need to be fulfilled in order to allow one or another country to move forward into European integration. We need to be able to look through the fake stories that we get from the political leaders in Kosovo, in Serbia, in Bosnia-Herzegovina today. And those are connected. I mean, if anyone will try to separate Kosovo issue from Bosnia and not put Serbia in the mix, I think it's a wrong calculation. Probably it was easier in Dayton time, but it should not be easier now. It has to be dealt all together. Which brings to the point, if dialogue is not working, if U.S. has been largely disengaged and has not been paying attention to its most successful and the greatest investment that has been in the Balkans, what is the solution? Is partition of northern Kosovo a solution? The partition of northern Kosovo is as bad as partition of the Bosnia. It's going, as it was said here, to put back the region in the turmoil, and it's not going to end with the issues of Kosovo, Serbia, Bosnia. It is going to trigger so much more problems. And imagine even now that the financial situation of those countries is so bad that probably this could be seen from some radical movements as an exit strategy from where they are. And I'm talking, as you can hear me, talking about radical elements, but they are very connected to the certain political leaders, including the criminal networks that we see in different reports. So if partition is not a solution, what is the solution? Northern Kosovo, I think it's a consequence of a game that is being played between Pristina and Belgrade, and we shouldn't fall for that. Belgrade has fell short of delivering on its promises to the people of Serbia about the economic recovery and a speedy way of European integration. So it needs a nationalistic card in northern Mitrovica to get the attention of everybody. Similarly, Pristina, I mean, certainly, it's very obvious, has completely failed to deliver to the people of Kosovo. It's the only country that has no visa liberalization. You have 2 million people living in a big prison in Kosovo. Afghanistan can travel to more countries than a Kosovar with a passport, which I think Kosovars can travel only to 5 in the world. So moving back to the solution, northern Kosovo deserves a large package of comprehensive development package, which does not have as its aim to incorporate Serbs into the Kosovar institutions, but rather to have Serbs include them into the Kosovar society. And this has been a constant failure of Kosovar leadership, and I would say to a certain extent European Union leaders, of trying by at any cost to get Serbs into the institutions. No, I think that's a will, like it is everywhere in the world. It should be their decision. But including Kosovo Serbs into the Kosovo society, it should be done, and it should be done properly, not to allow that incentives from Belgrade to keep dubious thoughts about why Kosovar Serbs from north should not be incorporated into the Kosovo society. Serbs from northern Kosovo certainly are not bigger Serbs than Serbs in southern Kosovo. If there is a successful integration of Serbs in the south, then north can be integrated fully. We just need to know that the problem is not in the north. The problem is in Belgrade, and the problem is in Pristina. the negotiations should not be happening around five people that are presented as heads of the parallel structures in the north, but rather with Belgrade and Pristina from European Union and United States with one voice. And I know what I'm asking, it's a very difficult thing, but unless this one voice happens, I think we are going to see a prolonged process and even further danger of ending up in different bigger conflicts than what we have now in northern Mitrovica. So I want to believe and I want to conclude that the financial crises are a challenge, but at the same time, it's a good opportunity for the European Union to actually know how it spends its funds in a lot more careful way. What are the people and groups that are being empowered? Expand itself beyond the clubs and the people that it talks in the capitals, but include a large civil society groups, think tanks, that can provide very good analysis by now, 20 years of funding and supporting them, in how the solutions should look like. I do not think that the time is to bring solutions out of envelopes in Kosovo on any different level. We should stop believing that the Balkan societies are not capable of providing solutions to themselves. Yes, they are. We just need to create the space. And that space, it will never be created unless EU and US changes the approaches and really, fundamentally, gives the voice to the people rather than only to the leaders. Thanks.
Haki, thank you so much. That was an enormous amount of food for thought, and I know it will stimulate a lot of good discussion. Before we begin to take questions from the floor, if I might take the moderator's prerogative and just go down the table. This is not an uplifting conversation. This is obviously huge challenges, but I wonder if you could each very briefly, as you look into this crystal ball of the region, what's the one thing that keeps you awake at night as far as tripping into to potential violence? Obviously, we've had violence on the border, but as you look either at Serbia, Kosovo specifically, and look at it regionally, what is the one thing that you're keeping your eye on and it's really causing you great concern as we look towards the future? Put you on the spot first, sir.
That's an easy question.
Sorry.
It's the interchangeability between criminality and government, especially in Kosovo, where they have become almost one and the same.
I hadn't put it in those terms before, but I think as difficult as the situation in Kosovo is, I worry a little bit more about Bosnia. And I worry about that because the forces that are driving the RS into greater and greater separatism are having ripple effects in the Croat community and then therefore in the Federation. And the international community as a whole doesn't seem to have a grip on it. So that without anyone intending to do so, you can see these trends just going further and further until there's that catalyst, and then you're behind the curve.
Well, I hope Franz Ferdinand is not going to come back to Sarajevo, so no war will start from the Balkans. But I think in the long term, what I would put is, I hope U.S. and European Union are not going to be tired with the Balkans and at one point will accept, especially European Union, some kind of joining EU under kind of conditions of southern Italy, where crime and criminality can co-live with the society but still be part of European Union and be treated differently. I think it is a great leverage for European Union and United States to actually have a very clear pathway of, not to say roadmap, of the Balkans moving forward. Am I optimistic that this is going to happen? I think unless that happens, EU is not going to have any credibility anywhere in the world to deal with the problems if it doesn't deal with the problem on its own backyard. The same with U.S. too.
So there are two hopeful signs.
Okay, there, good.
And we shouldn't be remiss in finding optimism. One is that you're all here today and that this audience Amen. Is so ample and so distinguished. that's testimony to the fact that people who have worked on the Balkans for decades, people like Jim and Bob and many others here, still care deeply about it. I think the other cause for optimism is the fact that all three of the panelists, though we may differ slightly in our conclusions, have been very realistic in our assessments. There's been no happy talk here from the podium. And being realistic is a starting point for new thinking and new approaches, which is the purpose of your report and our gathering.
Oh, you're good. Thank you so much. All right, with that, let's open the floor for a good conversation. There was a lot of meat here placed on the table. So please, questions. We have a question here in the front. And again, please, your name and affiliation. Again, just to remind everyone, this is on the record.
Ross Johnson, Wilson Center. I'm for David Phillips. Realignment is an intriguing notion. If it's not status quo, if it's not changes in geopolitical borders, what is it?
You can pursue state building and fighting corruption at the same time as you reject ethnic partition and recognize that there are organic affinities that exist. When you deny those organic affinities that are based on history and culture and trade, you thwart national aspirations that are manifest at a individual and at a civil level. So realignment is a kind of virtual reorganization of nations that in fact helps strengthen the existing state structures by allowing individuals to manifest their goals.
Mirza Velagic, I'm an intern at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And my question is to Mr. Volker. So pretty much, as we've seen in the 90s, the EU has failed Bosnia. It wasn't capable to prevent the conflict and the genocide or to help the Bosnian people. We've seen that the US is absolutely essential in helping the people of the region move on, move forward. And as you stated, the US needs to get more engaged. But the question is, how do we get the US more engaged? With all these conflicts going on around the world, all these distractions going on, how do we get the U.S. policy, the State Department, to be more engaged in the Balkans, to spend more energy, time, and to think of new creative solutions? Thank you.
First off, I have to react to Dr. Phillips' comment about the reason for optimism is the degree of pessimism on the panel, which right, reminds me of a Hungarian joke, which is the pessimist who says that things really can't get any worse, and the optimist who says, oh, yes, they can. That's exactly the right question. So you want to see more U.S. leadership. What would that look like? How would you do that? I'll offer two things. One of them, recognizing the domestic problems here, the budget problems here, the fatigue that we have as a result of Afghanistan and Iraq, all take that as a given. But I would suggest that there are at least two things I could think of. One of them, Secretary Clinton has done remarkable work in areas that she has sunk her teeth into, I have to say. And I was very impressed, for example, with her recent visit to Pakistan. And she knows this region. She's traveled there in the past. She cares about it. And I think that she could put a little bit of her own personal weight into this, together with EU leaders, to raise the profile of the need for political push. And I would say that one of the advantages we have now compared to the past is we don't need a big military engagement right now. We tend to get serious when that's what's required. And, of course, that's a very expensive and dangerous and difficult proposition. We have the luxury of not having to do that right now. So we could put more of a political push into it. And I would hope that she would be willing to take that on. I think she could play a rather unique role in catalyzing more effort and more focus. So that's one. The second thing is there is not currently a focused process in place aimed at addressing the specific political issues that need to be resolved in both Kosovo and in Bosnia. In Bosnia, it's really flat on its back. In Kosovo, there's this EU-sponsored dialogue, But as Mr. Abbasi said, it's kind of opaque as to what it is and what it's trying to achieve. And I think a higher profile and more structured process for pushing these political issues with some degree of focus and sustained effort. So you might need to then say, okay, Assistant Secretary Gordon or Special Envoy so-and-so, you know, we, the United States, in the form of Secretary Clinton, the EU, in the form of the presidency or whomever, are going to have a sustained focus process to put on the table all the real issues. In the case of Bosnia, I just want to say that I think it is helpful to use the phrase Dayton II. I know it's controversial to use that phrase too, but I think we have to say, first off, the Dayton Accords are the basis of everything that we're doing and we're not going back. But also, we recognize that they are not sufficient for the long-term future of the country, and we have to give it a much more substantial push. I think the problem with the Butmir process was that it wasn't sustained and ambitious and focused enough. It's not that we tried and failed. It's that we could have tried even more and should.
Kurt, given the demands on the Secretary's time, you alluded to the possibility of a special envoy for the Secretary of State. Is that a proposal that you're endorsing?
I think it's up to the administration to decide how it is comfortable organizing its own efforts. There have been cases where we've done special envoys. There have been cases when we've used the assistant secretary. Richard Holbrooke was assistant secretary when he was doing these things. It doesn't really matter. What matters is the priority placed on it by the administration and saying this is something that we think we can actually get done and are willing to put some political weight behind getting it done.
Can I two-finger that? Because I want to pick up on Hockey's, I think, a very important statement about civil society, about the people. That's a leadership model. It's driving the political lead and the leadership. How does U.S. strategy pull in the civil society, the people element? Again, I think Secretary Clinton's personal leadership and her outreach to civil society is, again, an element. But we need to I think we're making this such an elite project, and we're not bringing the civil society into it. That's a mistake because it's got to be top-down, but it's also got to be bottom-up. What's the strategy moving forward for civil society engagement?
I just add one thought on that, or two thoughts on that, actually. One of them is that when you create a process, if you're going to call it a Dayton II, or you're going to create an equivalent thing for Mitrovica, that you want to have an open process. It's not a secret closed negotiation. It's an open thing so that people can see. And secondly, you allow vehicles for civil society to provide input and to hear responses so that it becomes more interactive. I think that you're right to highlight that because if you're only focusing on the political leaders, you're still stuck in the same problem that we're stuck in. So I would say that. Second thing is that we have continued to ratchet down U.S. assistance in the region in favor of other parts of the world and in favor of overall reductions, which I understand and I think is has been necessary. But if we are going to make this kind of concerted political effort to try to break through some of the stagnation, it would be worth rethinking. Is there a period of time in which some additional support to civil society would be a wise thing to do?
We're going to get to you, I promise. Go, Dave.
That kind of assistance, to my experience, should focus on the business community. The Greek-Turkish Business Council, the Turkish-Armenian Business Development Committee are examples of business leaders getting together, focusing on the bottom line, and driving the public policy discourse based on commercial interests. I know that the Helsinki Committee for Human Rights in Serbia has had a series of dialogues between Serb and Albanian business representatives. Those meetings should be happening regularly. There should be subgroups. The reason they're not isn't for lack of imagination or leadership. It's for lack of resources. So when we think about spending money more strategically, and certainly Paki can speak to this, our friends from the NED can as well, figuring out how you leverage your resources by identifying key constituencies like business leaders is one way to engage civil society and get a larger return.
As long as it breaks that link between the criminal, you know, that's where good business practice, good governance is so important. Hockey, you got to jump in here. You got to give us some framing.
I don't think there is also a large issue of resources. I think the process has been completely occupied by a very small circle of people. where international community and U.S. plays its own role. I mean, before, right after the conflict, it was a lot more open. There was more, a lot more space. And as things got worse, there was less space. I would be very careful with business because I think it's going to take a lot of time when business becomes a very clean, or to the extent that it can be a clean business. So if we continue to empower wrong businesses, they will go back and empower the wrong politicians, because in the end of the day, it's the election campaigns. It's the money that buys the votes in Kosovo, in Serbia, and in Bosnia. Unfortunately, but that's the case. You can have the best electoral law. In the end of the day, the election results are coming out of the powerful secret services in the region and political party activists that are connected to the powerful businesses. I think U.S. cannot afford to go back and not respect its own principles about democracy. And lately, we have seen that happening in the Balkans, where there is no enough effort to be open and inclusive about who gets engaged in the discussions. I mean, lately in Kosovo, we know how U.S. has also excluded some of the political parties from the process of very important decisions, which has never been the case in Kosovo before. All tough discussions have been done in a kind of very consensual basis. I don't know much about Bosnia, how that process is going, but European Union cannot fall into that mistake of having high officials and meet one or two people and then exclude others from the debate, being civil society or the political parties that might not talk things that they would like to hear. So the problem, if we end up in the corner that we talk only to people that we'd like what they say, then the process is having a really, really serious problems, and the deficit in democracy is going to be growing.
It's a very important point that we just don't reach out to the same old suspects, and we identify new interlocutors, and don't gravitate to those that write proposals well or speak English, but can really affect community action on the ground.
Fantastic points. Sorry about that, but that was a great exchange. Thank you. What I'd like to do in the next 10 minutes is bundle a couple of questions, and I saw some hands over there. So we're going to take a rapid series of questions, and then, panelists, I'm going to ask you to respond. So over there, please. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Gilbert. I'm the ambassador of Albania. Thank you for the presentations. They've been excellent. I belong to the group of optimists, because if you take the region 20 years ago and see where it is now, I think pretty much has been done. So all the countries have moved forward, and it's I think, in the right track. Of course, not perfect, with a lot of problems, all kinds of problems. My real issue is, we talk a lot about change, and even here it's time for change, but I think the real name of the game should be managing change, because this is taken for granted very frequently, and it's a big miscalculation. If you take the leaders in Balkans, it is taken for granted that they know how to manage change. Don't forget that from a teacher or a medical doctor, the next morning they found themselves in the seat of a minister, prime minister, or even president. So it's not that easy. And the question is, exactly for that, Mr. Phillips and Mr. Walker. So do you think that EU and US were/are really prepared to manage change in our region? Thank you.
My name is Avni Mustafai. I'm with the National Albanian American Council. With respect to Northern Mitrovica, the Artisari Pact has made very clear that the minorities in Kosovo have the broadest rights of any minority in Europe. And I know that there's been a discussion about including Northern Mitrovica in a dialogue or having another discussion on it. So my question is, what would be discussed, since the rights for the minorities are already included in the Artisari Pact? And wouldn't you be going backwards and opening up a pact that has already been closed and agreed for moving forward?
Good morning. My name is Perry Olevsky. I work at Blue Star Strategies, a consulting firm that does a lot of consulting in Central Eastern Europe. First of all, I would like to thank you for being here. And my question relates to Macedonia. As you all know, in 2008, Macedonia was blocked by Greece in entering NATO. However, we all know that the two countries have an interim agreement with the United Nations that Greece should not block Macedonia in accessing international organizations such as NATO or European Union. NATO and the European Union are both led by Western forces, all leaders in respect of law and based on principles. When do you think that some of the leaders of NATO and European Union will say, enough is enough, and we need to stop respecting justice and the rule of law? Thank you.
Thanks. Jim Hooper, Public International Law and Policy Group. This is a question for either of the three. When Chancellor Merkel visited Belgrade in August, she publicly called for Serbia to come to terms with the independence of Kosovo and to dismantle the parallel structures in northern Kosovo. This was an explicit criticism of the policy of the Belgrade government, and appeared to be an implicit criticism of the minimalist approach that Brussels has taken to negotiating between the two. Given the fact that what the internationals do and the large shadow that Berlin casts on European policy, I would ask any of the three of you that wish to comment, which of the two, Brussels or Berlin, do you think will prevail given the tension between them on Serbia, and Kosovo?
Thank you so much. Those were, we'll sneak one more right there.
Claude Delenici with American University. I have two questions, please. And I was wondering why Mr. Kurti isn't here today. I was expecting actually to hear from him too. Mr. Walker, when you mentioned that there is insufficient leadership in the Balkans, what is the direct influence that is going to have this in Kosovo in terms of stability and development? And the second question is for Mr. Abwazi. When you talked about the isolation of Kosovo, do you have something particular in mind that we can do to stop this isolation and help the development of the youth, considering that Kosovo has an enormous human capacity development? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll take your question regarding Mr. Kurti. He was invited to speak here this morning. His visa was not granted to him in time to attend this conference. So he was invited, but unfortunately was not provided a visa in time. You got some very tough questions, my friends. So, Haki, I think we're going to start with you, and we'll work the other way down the table. And we have about 2 minutes each. Each question deserves a much more time. But if you could respond to those questions and any closing thoughts you have. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll start with the Kosovo being isolated. I think it's a duty of the Kosovo authorities to do the homework and to begin with. Only then we can kind of Kosovo can go back and ask from European Union to grant the same rights and the benefits of the that European Union has granted to the other countries. That says doesn't mean that EU or US is completely not to be blamed, because if Macedonia, if Albania, if even Bosnia-Herzegovina with a lot of problems could get visa liberalization, Kosovo with all international presence and executive powers of international actors did not even fulfill the elementary kind of a basic conditions. So it's a blame for everyone. That's why I started with the issue of not functioning the way it's constructed. The second, if I may just, Berlin or Brussels, I think that's one of the biggest problem, that EU is not speaking with one voice. Even the office of Cathy Ashton with Fule and Barroso do not have the same message for the Balkan. I don't even ever heard about a same approach that they have toward the Balkans. And this, what I call ambiguity, that the Balkan leaders can and know how to swim the best and come up with the crazy ideas that we see coming up in the region. I don't think I can comment much about Macedonia, but it would be similar as Kosovo, I think the Macedonian leadership has to show more of a willingness and being proactive of European agenda rather than building Skopje with the crazy statues and monuments that further basically further creates more problem with Greece, but also other people in the region as well.
Thanks. I think in hearing the questions, I need to stress a point that I failed to make earlier. I'm not suggesting that the United States or the EU should be devising and imposing solutions on the Balkans. And I want to be clear about that. I'm suggesting that we need to be the catalysts for insisting and pushing people in the region to come to closure on their own problems. It's an important distinction because an imposed solution will ultimately be one that's resisted and unstable. What we're looking for is long-term stability and security. And to start with the last question first, that's the link to stability and development. If your political structures are unresolved and if you are empowering leaders who have a personal and political interest in keeping the region somewhat unstable, then you're never going to get long-term stability and development. And so I think that that is the link to taking a larger political push at resolving issues. Now, to address a couple of the specific questions, with that in mind, the question was, are the U.S. and the EU ready to manage change? I'd say not at the moment. We ought to be. That's what we should aim toward. With respect to Mitrovica, I don't think anyone is suggesting that you need to change the package of minority rights that's already been developed for Serbs in northern Kosovo or Serbs in Kosovo. But I do think that we have still unresolved political structures relating to northern Kosovo in terms of how it deals with Pristina and how Belgrade deals with Mitrovica. Those are the things that I think need to be sorted out. With respect to Macedonia, I refer you to the testimony that I did give last week, but it was not part of the exam question from the committee, but I threw it in anyway. I would offer two thoughts. I think one of them, it serves no one's interest, not the Greeks, not the Macedonians, not the wider Balkans, not the EU, not the U.S., for this name issue to persist unresolved. And in fact, because it's unresolved, things have gone backwards in Macedonia, and they've been, as Mr. Abbasi said, using controversial ancient symbols of ancient Macedonia in order to rally the public and to distract from other issues. And I think that has set all the issues back. So what I would suggest is that, especially given the difficulties that Greece is dealing with for a whole set of other reasons, we should try to make the 1995 interim agreement stick for the purpose of membership in organizations so that we can get on with that and simultaneously have a more direct U.S. and EU role in support of the UN to actually try to come to some closure in the name negotiations, because the elements of a solution, I think, have all been on the table for a long time. I think we all kind of know what's out there. It's just that no one has had the will to bring the negotiations to closure. On Jim's question, Jim Hooper, about Berlin and Brussels, that's a great question. I noted Merkel's visit. At the present time, I think Brussels wins. I don't think Berlin has the commitment and sustainability behind what Merkel said. Therefore, what we should try to do is figure out how we can create diplomatic and political devices to reinforce that German commitment, matched perhaps by more U.S. commitment, and push Brussels so that we do end up in more of that assertive position. And I think that is possible if we put our shoulder to it. Thanks.
Gilbert, it should be noted that Albania is not on the agenda for this conference because of its economic developments, its infrastructure construction, its IT advances. Albania is really setting a gold standard in the region, and that's recognized through its NATO membership and visa liberalization. As to your question, can the U.S. and the EU or the EU manage change? Of course they can, but they choose not to. They pay attention to these issues when there's violence, because violence is an action-causing event. Avni, your question about the Ahtisaari plan, The Ahtisaari plan is a bit of a misnomer because it is now the Kosovo Constitution. The adoption of the Ahtisaari principles into the Constitution in June of 2008 is a testimony to Kosovo's commitment to minority rights. And there's no reason to reopen that package or renegotiate elements. Implementation may be uneven, but implementation can be supported and assisted, particularly with better political leadership. And on Jim's question about Berlin versus Brussels, you know, I've agreed with almost everything that you've said. I would differ in this instance. It seems to me that whoever has the money has the horsepower. Germany's perspective, to me, will prevail. Besides, the EU has already learned from inviting Cyprus into its midst the problems that arise when you bring dysfunctional situations into the EU, and I don't think it's inclined to do that with any of the Western Balkan countries, including Serbia at this juncture.
Well, let me begin by thanking our three panelists for three very impressive presentations. And let me thank you. The questions were equally impressive, and that stimulated a wonderful discussion. So please join me in thanking our three panelists.